Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. Phil Whitehawk is of Cherokee descent and is a singer-songwriter living in Palermo, Maine. He has written over 350 songs, three dramatic musicals, and a compilation of essays on social anthropology called Circling the Square. He and his wife, Connie, toured for nearly 30 years across the U.S., Canada, and Europe with a live multimedia concert of original songs and artwork dealing with the cultural history and heritage of North America from a Native point of view. Their inspirational performances elicited well over 800 standing ovations from audiences of all ages. Phil, welcome to the Institute, and thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we're going to explore Native spirituality today. We're going to do some medicine talk about the medicine walk and explore your music and listen to some as well. But first, let me ask you, what was it about your shows that elicited such response over those years? What was it you were conveying to your audiences?
Well, we're trying to take some of the old traditional ideas that emanate from the culture, the Native American culture as practiced for thousands of years, and make it into a presentation in plain English using very powerful techniques of guided imagery. We had over 1,200 award-winning slides back in the days where you had projectors and you had dissolve units, and it was really quite magical. We used rear projection, and we zoomed about the country. We went to every state. We went to every province of Canada. We toured Europe. So it was a wonderful experience lasting over 30 years.
And this was for the benefit of schools and students?
We went around and did shows for service clubs, for art societies, for schools, for colleges, for universities. We used it as a fundraiser for all manner of nonprofit, non-governmental organizations.
And let's start with where you found your inspiration. Perhaps that starts with your own journey.
Well, my mother was born in Lenapaw, Oklahoma, in the Indian Territory. It says right there on her birth certificate, Indian Territory, you know, writ large. But she left the reservation at a very young age, and took a degree in public health. And her game plan was to graduate and take her expertise and her skills back to her own people and to devote her life to her own people. But in her 32-year-plus career in public service, she never got back home. She was always zooming about the countryside and working with many, many different tribes and many, many different environments with many, many different health challenges. And ultimately, she retired from Alaska at the regional Native hospital up there. So here she is traveling about, and I'm the kid. And I'm traveling about with her. And I'm kind of the Native American version of a scion or a child of a soldier that just goes from station to station.
And this was out west.
Mainly out west.
So your nation, your heritage is?
Well, I went to the Albuquerque Indian School. I went to private schools. I went to a Catholic boarding school. I had a stint in the Navy. I was a police officer for a while in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and finally graduated from the University of Arizona with a degree in public administration. And when I graduated, I decided, well, I guess I'm just going to go and try and be a songwriter. I was supposed to be a lawyer. My family wanted me to be a lawyer. And
why is that?
Well, in the old days, this is just one generation past. My mother passed away about 7 years ago at the age of 82. But our parents wanted us to be productive members of society. They wanted us to be articulate. They wanted us to speak English well. And a lot of times this unfortunately led to the fact that many of us did not learn our native language. But in a way, being traveling around and being kind of the odd man out, I didn't like it at the time. But later on in retrospect, I realized that I had acquired so much invaluable knowledge from the various elders I had been exposed to along the lines that were inspirational. They were little seeds in my heart and in my mind, and eventually, since I was a musician and since I was a writer, they started to emerge as show that we called Inspirata Americana. And we pulled it together during the Bicentennial of America, and that's how long we've been doing it, up until about 6 years ago when we retired the show.
Now, when you say odd man out, you were traveling with your mom,
mm-hmm.
and you are of a Cherokee background?
Yes.
And you were visiting many of the Western tribes?
Yes.
Is it you were odd man out?
Well,
how did that play out in your life?
You never really accepted as a tribal peer if you're not of the same tribe. And even in Indian school, the Hopis would stick together, Navajos would stick together, the Apaches would stick together, and so forth. And so here I am. I'm not a member of any of those tribes. But the thing about it is that generation was kind of turning their back a little bit on their cultural heritage, and they were interested in assimilating. And me, since I was already not assimilated by anybody, I just had a curiosity about what they had to say. So I had just a number of elders that confided in me, mainly because they admired my mother and because I was interested when their own children were not. So that's the background of this.
Now, the elders, of course, that's a huge topic, and what they had to share that you I think soaked in as a young person. Do you recall some of the teachings that they shared that you could convey to us, to the audience, and their significance, the core that affected you?
Sure. Their main idea, and it's pan-tribal, is the balance of nature and man's custodianship of the earth and the recognition of its divine origin. Most of the native people in North America believed in a single creator, and they had a variety of names which translated in English went all the way from grandfather, grandmother, man above, great mystery. There was just a number of things when they translated into English gave you some idea of this belief that tribal people had. And they reinforced this belief with ceremony. See, the purpose of Native American ceremony is to achieve a greater understanding of the will of the great mystery in one's own personal life. And so there's many, many different ceremonies that go from tribe to tribe. Many of them are different. But our elders used to say that there were many, many paths up the mountain, but the treasure at the summit was the same for all. Mm-hmm. So this put it into focus, into perspective, the different ceremonial lives that people practice up and down the Rocky Mountains and well into Canada. You remember my mother went ahead and retired from Alaska, so I had teachers from the totemic cultures as well as the Pueblo cultures and as well as the plains and marginal plains cultures. So I became sort of a depository for some of the sayings and some of the aphorisms and some of the teachings of all of these people. And they came out in my art. They came out in my music. And so I devoted my life to it.
Your unique position just seems like a great blessing in terms of carrying so much knowledge, as you say, at a time where many were turning their back on the culture. Could you share a little more about that, about the culture? And I mean, we know historically how culture can be taken or broken. Can you speak a little bit to then the younger, you know, the more recent generations and their perception of things?
Well, now we've had a renaissance of interest in Native culture, and I'm not from that generation. I had to generate my own interest, but it's really wonderful that a lot of the old wisdoms are coming back. They're being published and they're being rediscovered. But when I was exposed to these things, they profoundly affected me, and the ceremonial life profoundly affected me. I recall this idea of getting a personal knowledge of one's spirit path was really super important to me. In the old days, young people would they called it Amla Chiapa in Sioux, and it means crying for a vision, literally crying for a vision. And young people would do this about the age of, say, a bar mitzvah youth. Why, they would embark upon a regimen, and it would be fasting, purification. It would be meditation, prayer, and solitude. Usually lasted 4 days, and you are out there alone with your thoughts and with yourself and with your inner being, and you're trying to answer the four great questions, the universal questions that every soul has on the earth. And it, number one, who am I? Number two, why am I here? Number three, what is it I'm supposed to be doing while I'm here on my visit? And number four, how do I get it done? And more important to the individual was the attitude that the identification of the individual spirit path was crucial, and the ongoing productivity of the earth, her ability to provide, and also her ability to purify herself unaided. So this is the kind of consciousness that was imbued with very, very young people in tribal culture, and of course we've lost that.
And you mean you've lost that in the tribal culture, or we've lost it across the board?
Well, there's a great difference in the persona of Western man, European Western man, the product of the Enlightenment, and tribal persona. In tribal persona, what we developed and we admired as traits was, number one, courage, number two, loyalty, and number three, generosity. No person in a tribe could become influential unless he could provide for the people and was generous and was brave in their defense. Well, you transfer it over to the dominant culture, and yes, we admire courage, of course. That's kind of universally admired in every culture. But then all of a sudden, we veered away, and in the modern consumer culture, we now admire cleverness, the ability to manipulate the environment and to manipulate other people. Mm. And then we also admire acquisitiveness. How much can we get? He who dies with the most toys wins. So there's very, very different, a vast difference in the persona of Western civilization, the kind that was created there, and tribal culture as it was created in North America.
And that's very interesting, Phil. And I imagine these things are, these messages are also reinforced so much through the media in our culture. The emphasis, you know, on me and myself and what I can get, as opposed to, as you, the four questions you mentioned before. And those are the key questions of life, aren't they?
Yes,
who
they
am
are.
I? Why am I here? What
role,
am I supposed to be doing?
Yeah. And the role
how
of the media.
Get it done?
The role of the media, and I consider it to be its lowest use that we're currently practicing, the pop culture, was one of the main emphasis for me starting Inspirata in the first place. I thought there has to be some kind of countervailing interest that would captivate people's attention other than just the pop culture, other than just, you know, the wine and circuses. So that was one of the main reasons why we started up with Inspirata and then and kept with it for so long.
Mm.
One of the things that I really wanted to point out while we're having our medicine conversation here was that you mentioned the medicine wheel, and the medicine wheel is one of the symbols of the universe. But we also have three others. We have the lodge itself, the buffalo himself, and we have the pipe. And all of these are different disciplines that require different expenditures of energy along those different paths. And the goal of all of this is self-awareness, self-fulfillment, and it's very similar to the yogic goal of unity with the divine. We like to get a better understanding of the will of the great mystery in our own lives. And the medicine wheel is it has an origin. It has a little axis, a little center spot in the medicine wheel. And the elders used to tell me that is the one. The one became the many, but the many can't remember how it was. So,
yeah.
So what we're doing in our earthly existence is we are trying to remember what we forgot. And that's the idea of self-realization in the spirit path.
You know, we hear that pretty often from people on the program from many different walks and faiths, that there's a forgetting, then that there's also a remembering or a trying to remember lately that's come back into the culture. Because, of course, on a personal level, if we don't know those four questions, it'll come back to get us later. At midlife, you'll be asking, why am I here? If
exactly.
You don't, you know, as a younger person.
We had a ceremony for that, too. We absolutely had a ceremony for that. It was called the Change of Medicine.
The Change of Medicine?
The Change of Medicine.
Tell us about the ceremonies.
Well, there
are more, please.
Yeah, what would happen is you would go on a second quest. And when you went on the second quest many times, your experiences would be so powerful, and they would be interpreted by other spiritual leaders in your environment, and frequently they resulted in a name change. And then you became a whole different person. It was like you were being reborn again. You were like following the middle road, what we would call, what the Buddhists would call the middle road, what Indians would call the good red road.
Mm-hmm.
And you were seeking to balance things. You were seeking to close the hoop of the individual, to close the hoop of the community, close the hoop of the nation, close the hoop of the Earth Mother, and become proper stewards of the gifts of the Great Spirit. So our lives were filled with ceremonies, and they're all designed to achieve a greater understanding of the will of the mystery in our lives. And it's just an ongoing thing. Of course, we call the great mystery because we acknowledged that we're never going to know everything. We're never going to be as wise or as powerful as our Creator. But we can put energy into a greater understanding and greater accumulative knowledge that we can pass on. In the old days, it was done with the oral tradition. But now our tribe, the Cherokees, developed an alphabet early on, and so now we're able to write it down.
And the ceremonies, do they begin with at birth, and go through life? What are you mentioned the ceremony of life for the young person, and then the change of medicine. What other ceremonies
are
there?
Well, you have a welcoming ceremony at the birth, and then as the infant gets older, he's educated by members of the extended clan and the extended family. You have to remember now that it's a very great difference in the dominant culture and the native culture, in that descent in the tribal culture is through the mother. There's a saying that the womb does not lie.
That the womb is what?
The womb does not lie.
Yes.
So the child actually belongs to the clan of the mother, and not the clan of the father. And the son does not take the father's name. And moreover, the father is not an authoritarian figure to his own children. However, he is an authoritarian figure and a role model to members of his own clan that were given birth by his female siblings. Hmm. So that's why in native culture the term uncle is so honorific. It's more like a father or patron or patron or grandfather. It's, you know, it doesn't mean the same as it does in English.
That's powerful. Thank you, Phil. So we have the welcoming ceremony, the youth ceremony. Do they basically, you mentioned being sort of pan-tribal, do we find these celebrations and basic philosophies across different nations and tribes?
Oh, absolutely. They take different forms, of course. You know, a dweller in the southwestern desert is not going to have the same plants, the same flora that
right.
he uses in the ceremony as somebody from the climax forest of the northwest. So you'll have different environments. You'll have different modes of dress. What was interesting to me when I was at university studying anthropology, that the anthropologist would show up at a ceremony and he would faithfully record everything. I mean, how many feathers the guy wore, when they came in, what kind of geometry their circles were, what kind of dance steps they had, how long it lasted, who was speaking and what his rank was. But they never really ask, well, why are these people doing this? So it was the triumph of technique over purpose.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, we have that tendency to want to capture something. You see it in our culture. We want to photograph everything. And, you know, people always taking out their cell phones to try to capture something. But they may not be asking, why? Why do I want to capture this? And for what? What is the meaning of it? So, of course, it's the meaning in everything that is the, you know, or the, you know, the underlying meaning that is more the, I guess, the purpose. That you have a ceremony because of a purpose, and can you speak a little more about the great mystery, about the grandfather and grandmother, and our connection?
Sure.
And how is that lived out in our life?
Well, first of all, it's a conceptual idea that you have to accept as a matter of faith. An atheist will say, "Well, forget it." You know, there's no such thing as Aristotle's prime mover. Forget it. But if you have an innate desire to experience what cannot be seen and what cannot be described, then you become interested in the spiritual life. And every great founder of every great religion has gone through this. And with us, we have this idea that the great mystery fragmented itself. It fragmented itself because of desire. It wanted an experiential side of its existence, a corporeal side, a physical side. So it fragmented into the universe and the universe of universes. It's endless. The mechanism that it had for experiencing is consciousness, that sense of I am that I am, that sense that that the individual is the subjective center of the universe. And, they've had all of these recent astronomical discoveries, and now they have decided, the scientists, they always want to measure things. The scientists have an innate desire to measure things, to quantify things, to put things into a physical perspective. So they can't really figure out, ever since Hubble's telescope, they can't really figure out why the universe is still expanding at ever faster rates. And to explain this, they have gone on this search of all over the universe that they can examine from this point, or measure from this point, of this so-called material called dark matter. Because if dark matter exists, it's the only way that they can explain the expansion of the universe. Well, Native people in ancient times, sitting around the campfire, had a logical explanation for all of this. And that was the great mystery breathes out, and the universes appear. It breathes in, and they disappear.
Huh.
So we weren't really looking for dark matter. We had this idea that the universe had no end, had no beginning, and that the center of the universe was everywhere. So we had this idea pretty early, and it took scientists to go through the Enlightenment and several world wars, conflicts, and all kinds of stuff to figure out that, you know, they don't know everything. And we knew that already. That's why they call it the mystery.
Well, that's the difference, though, is the need to either name something, to put it in a kind of in a box, or to actually enjoy the mystery. And that is a I think those are two, you know, points of view that can be conflicting culturally. Now, you address a lot of this in your music. You write so much about alignment with nature and the great spirit, the great father, and our role. Is this a part of what you were conveying to all those audiences, and how did they respond?
Oh, it was wonderful. I had a little anecdotal story that I told your husband earlier, and so I thought I'd just zoom it out here. We were doing a show in Nebraska, and we were doing a K-12, and we were in the gymnasium, and we had our great screen behind us, and we had all of our equipment set up. It took a 2.5 hour setup to set this stuff up, and in came the students, and they filled up the bleachers, and the kindergartners came in with their teachers, and they had spread the wrestling mats on the ground, on the floor of the gym, and all the little squigglers sat down, and they were just having a great time because they were right in front of the action. They were right in front of all their peers that were superior in age, right? And they were right next to me where they could see me work my electronics with my feet and see the guided imagery on the screen. And so the teachers came to me and said, the little ones are not going to sit here on these mats for a full period. So you will call a halt at a convenient part in the presentation. We will take them back to the classroom because they will just get out of hand if we leave them there, right? So I said, are you sure you want me to do this? Oh, yes, they said. So about halfway through, I stopped, and the teachers turned the lights on, and they said the little ones are going back to their classrooms now. And it was just remarkable experience because they turned into limp nuclear protesters. they would not leave. I mean, they would have to drag each one of them off individually. And so finally they decided to just let them watch the entire show. What they had interrupted was the story of the development of the American character from its tribal origins, going through its various historical stages. And it was an adventure story that was of imminent interest to everybody who was, you know, born in this country.
Right.
And so I got to thinking about this afterwards. And it seemed to me that the teachers did not have a proper opinion of the abilities of their students. And they were, in fact, selling them rather short. Mm. They didn't have an opinion, they didn't have a very good opinion of the material that they were able to absorb. And so I think that is prevalent in the schools today.
Mm.
But Inspirata Americana was a wonderful tool. Just in one year in 76, the Arts Council of Nebraska sent us around to do the schools in Nebraska. We did all the schools in Nebraska, like 68,000 students in the schools. And I was in a summer visit down to Old Araby, where one of my teachers were in Hopi Land. And I came up to Mina Lance, and I was kind of puffed up about myself having done so many bright students. And I told her that we had done, you know, 60,000, over 60,000 students in the schools in Nebraska in one season. And she just kind of looked at me kind of in a nonplussed way, in a non-impressed way. And she said, well, go out and do another 60,000.
Yeah. Okay, time for the next day.
So I did over the years, and I'm going to be 74 next month. And the show has now been retired for about 6 years. But it was a great ride. It was a great ride. Our average audience was about 300, and then the largest live audience was 6,000 at the Lincoln Coliseum in Nebraska. And then the largest general audience was 3.5 million on Dutch national television. So we took this idea of edutainment and went about as far with it as we could.
Well, thank you, Phil. We're about halfway through the program now. We're going to stop for a station ID. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break, but after the break, we'll continue our conversation on Native American spirituality with singer-songwriter Phil Whitehawk. Here is The Messenger, the title track from Phil's latest CD. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking about Native spirituality with singer, songwriter, and educator Phil Whitehawk. Now, when I think back on the past three decades, a moving film from the 80s comes to mind. You might recall Koya Niskatsi, from a Hopi word for life out of balance. And this challenge appears to be more and more critical in our lives, the need for balance. And so in this part of the program, I'd like to explore a little more deeply the topic of medicine wheel philosophy. You mentioned some of it in the previous half hour, Phil, the medicine wheel, the lodge, buffalo, and pipe. If we could get deeper into this philosophy now, I think that would be of great meaning.
Well, the The first thing that a person needs to do is to go to the medicine wheel. And if you're ever in Lander, Wyoming, a short drive up to the pathway up to the hill where the medicine wheel is located, and you have to remember this thing is ancient. It's older than a lot of the surrounding tribal entities. It was put there by an ancestral race of we don't really know how exactly old it is, but there it is, and you can get aerial shots of it on the postcards, right? You hike on up there, and it's surrounded now by a fence put up by the Park Service so that people can't disturb it. But Native people go up there all the time, and it's festooned with offerings, with prayer feathers, with tobacco offerings, with meditation packets. People come up there because it's a pilgrimage. It's very much like the Buddhist pilgrimage. You have one to the place where he was born, and one to the
right.
place where he was enlightened, one to the place where he started teaching, and one to the place where he passed away. Four, to us, is also a sacred number. There are 28 spokes in the medicine wheel representing the days of the lunar month. They radiate outward to the nth degree. I mean, if you take the spokes and you continue them out, then they would diverge from one another forever. And then on the forever part, if you followed them back, they would converge to the one central part of the wheel.
Yes.
And one of the things that we always strive to do, I mentioned this earlier in the show, is this idea of closing of a hoop. And this is very much on the forefront of people who follow that path is harmony, because nothing is square in nature. I mean, they're always curved in some way or another. They're always
right.
cycle in some way or another. And the cycle, the circle, is sacred. And it gives you your place, and it places you in the environment where you can discern the place of other beings. So when you close the circle of the individual, what that means is you're working on your own self-awareness, and you're working on your self-fulfillment, you're working on your own enlightenment. When you go into the sweat lodge for purification, why, you leave all of your personal agendas at the door. You go in there solely for the purpose of realization of the means of perfecting yourself and the means of helping others who are your brothers in the lodge of ascending into consciousness. So the politics are left at the door. The personal ambition is left at the door. The personal enmities are left at the door. And inside the lodge is a wonderful experience. And I was quite upset when one of the things of the news, like 60 people down there in Arizona and Sedona died in a sweat lodge. It was sort of a commercialized aspect of a sacred thing. And I thought to myself when I read that newscast, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, they've gone ahead and tried to commercialize this and they've suffered the consequences. And really, tobacco, we'll just take tobacco as an example. Some of our elders called it, they would smile, and they would call it the great revenge of the Native people. Because, I mean, to us, when it was like incense in the Catholic Church.
Right.
It would rise up into the nave and up to the presence of divinity. Well, we have the same idea with tobacco. It's raised by special people. It's harvested by special people. It's prepared in a special way, and it's used ceremonially. And it's not supposed to be a part of an oral posture, or part of a subculture consumption thing, or part
right, of
a
part of your daily diet.
Yes, and so the old people would tell us. They said, if you defile the sacred plant, it will harm you. That's what they would say, it would harm you. And if you continue to defile a sacred plant, it will kill you. So that was what the old people would say to us when they caught us smoking a cool cigarette out behind the wigwam there. They would say, that's not the way you do it. And those teachings, you know, they stick with people, especially if the explanation is given as to what the purpose of the sacred plant is. And the sacred plant is used throughout Native culture. I mean, you can go from the East Coast to the West Coast, and you'll find it in use. The Western tribes used to say that well, the pipe came from the East, and it did. It did. And along with this idea of tobacco as a sacred plant, came from the East and migrated out west into the Western tribes.
Now, the medicine wheel, the actual medicine wheel that it is on top of the Bighorn Range in Wyoming, it's 9,000 feet up and only reachable during the summer months. This is an 80-foot diameter wheel pattern made of stones, ancient.
And it's wonderful. Yeah, vibrations on the place are wonderful. And if you go up there with to make an offering or to do prayers with somebody who is with you who wants to do the same thing, it's just a marvelous experience. It's very much like a pilgrimage.
And this is also pan-tribal, this pilgrimage, as we would, you know, consider Mecca or Lourdes or other places, sacred, very sacred sites.
Exactly. People who have chosen that discipline, the people who have chosen that path to self-realization, that's exactly what it is.
And it just brings to mind also something across the ocean, another gathering of stones that is Stonehenge, also ancient and concentric circles, as a symbol over there with great energy as well in the area. Now, having been to, let's say, the medicine wheel, what next? How does it become practiced? How is it part of daily life on the progression?
Well, the main thing that you take from your experience at the wheel is the desire for self-improvement and the desire for compassion and helping others. If you can help others, if you have the ability to do it, why not? And the whole idea of balance of the individual and balance of the environment, balance of the community, of the nation, to eliminate or to ameliorate the negative impulses therein or the strife therein. You want to put energy into that effort because you're inspired by this whole idea of self-improvement, self-awareness that comes to you when you decide to adopt a discipline such as the wheel. Now, you remember, you can also be a pipe holder, and they have different ways of doing the same thing. Or you can, you know, participate in ceremonies in the Medicine Lodge, same idea. And the buffalo, of course, the buffalo among the plains and the high plains and the marginal plains was the symbol of the productivity of the earth. The plains people based their entire culture on this animal. I mean, they used every part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing was wasted. I mean, the bones were made into utensils. The marrow of the bones was rendered down into pemmican for long-distance traveling. The skin was used for the clothing and the lodges and the blankets. And the meat itself was considered to be highly nutritious and productive of high energy and long life. When the Indians came on the reservation after the great slaughter of the buffalo, I have a couple of songs about this. I'm going to send you some other albums.
Oh, good. Thank you.
But when the buffalo were destroyed, now they had to be on reservations, and they were on commodities which were furnished by many times corrupt Indian agents, and they were eating beeves that were raised by government agents and purchased by them and brought to them to the reservation so they could be fed. Well, the old people said that they didn't like it because the fat of the cow, the fat of the beef, made them sick.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, they discovered that, holy cow, buffalo meat is really good for you.
Yeah. Huh. Now, The medicine wheel I've heard you mention spins through time. Could you share some of that principle? I'd love to hear more about that.
The circle is like an endless circle. And when you contemplate it, it's very much like a mandala. And other cultures use the same symbolism to look at the not quantifiable, the things, the mysteries beyond understanding. And you symbolize this with that circle. And Native people do the same thing. And when you have a person who is pursuing that path, they devote their lives to it. I mean, they don't veer from that path because it's their individual path to self-realization. And as this goes on and on through time, why, it's one generation after the other that makes the same meditations and the same ceremonies and the same conclusions and adopts the same lifestyle. And it's when you say projecting through time, that's exactly what it does, because the circle is endless.
Thank you. And, you know, when you mentioned closing of circles, it also just reminds me of the concept of something eternal or eternity, much the way we talk about the closed circle of a wedding ring being the, you know, an eternal bond. You know, now the life lived through the philosophy of the medicine wheel. You have said it's a discipline that seeks to balance our emotional, physical, mental, and spiritual strengths, and consequently our relationships with all our relations, including Mother Earth and Father Sky. Could you share a little more about this, the relationships and balance, and how they're related, including how the medicine wheel relates to nature?
Well, as I said, it's a symbol of the universe, so it relates to all things. It relates to all things understandable and all things not understandable, all things in our awareness and all things out of our awareness, all things learned and all things unlearned. I don't know how to explain this. It's pretty inevitable. You have to have it requires a leap of faith. Just like any belief system does, and I took mine long ago, and I'm still following it. One of the anecdotal stories that I like to tell of one of our pipe holders, he's been written about so many times, and he has so many books written about him and articles written about him, was Black Elk. And we had a large Black Elk segment in our Inspirata show as we were traveling around. And we were funded by the Arts Council to go out in front of the Folger Shakespeare production of Black Elk Speaks, which was an entire theater production. So we were sent there in order to kind of prepare the community before this play came to town. And we were traveling around with Lucy Looksweiss, who is Black Elk's granddaughter, and it was one of the presentations that we actually did together. We did a matinee, and they did the evening. And it was the first time that that Lucy had seen the whole program together, what we did and what the Folger Shakespeare Company did. And when it was afterwards, she was crying, and she said, tonight I heard my father speak. And it's very interesting because... She's no longer with us, of course, but she was elderly at the time. But when Black Elk was teaching out on the res, he became a lay Christian pastor, because many Native people accepted Christianity as a layer of belief. And one of the young acolytes from the seminary.
That's okay. I went to seminary too.
From the seminary, he came up and confronted Black Elk, and he said, "I understand that you are a Christian pastor to your people, And Blackett said, yes. And he said, and I also understand that you are still a priest and you are an educator in the old ways to your people. And Blackett said, yes. And the seminarian said, well, don't you see a conflict in that? And Blackout made one of the really great comments. He said it was clear to him that the Great Spirit had appeared to the white man in the form of a man. He said, but it was also clear to him that it was true that the Great Spirit appeared to the Indian in the form of nature's animals. And then he says, since the Great Spirit is the author of all form, he may use any form whatsoever to his purpose. So the seminarian has no answer to this. There is no answer to it. And that's one of the great things about Native people, especially the old longhairs. They had this opinion that everything was sacred, that the church was everywhere, that you didn't have to put God in a box on Sunday morning.
Right.
One of the things that you were talking about, some of the other inner meanings of the medicine wheel, this is lengthy, but each cardinal direction has a color. Each cardinal direction has an animal. Each cardinal direction has a attribute. You can go on and on with these things. A lot of Native people would go ahead and they would study animals for wisdom. And I found myself doing it when we were living in Montana, and we raised a bear. We learned a lot from Harry the Bear just by watching him. We didn't make a pet out of him. We never touched him. He was an orphan, and we just fed him to get him through the winter. Otherwise, he would have starved because his mother had been shot by a hunter. And when he made it through the first winter, he showed up, and we continued to feed him, and he became a cause célèbre. And all of our friends, when they would go into Bozeman or they would go into Billings to a fancy restaurant, would bring us back doggy bags or bear bags for a hairy bear. But we were looking at these doggy bags because this was really good stuff, right? But anyway,
inner struggle.
we really learned a lot from Harry Bear, and almost all Native people obtain wisdom from animals. That's why they're so important to us. Like in the medicine wheel, the very top of it, facing north, would be the buffalo, and then on the east would be the eagle. The eagle is the first seer of the dawn, the high flyer, and his attribute is clairvoyance. He can see into the future. He can make predictions based on what he sees from his lofty perch. And then the southern or green is the earth. That's the little mouses down there. He's interested in survival. He has great attention to detail. He scurries about, and it doesn't bother anybody. He just wants to make it through his existence. And then on the west, of course, is the bear. And the bear, when he goes to sleep in the winter, he dreams. And when he dreams, he realizes his inner thoughts. His inner thoughts come to him, and he becomes a great healer, and he becomes a great force for good in the world when he awakens, because he has wisdom. So these are just some of the things in the medicine wheel. There's animals all around the medicine wheel. They have gradations of color. It's really interesting when you get to follow it.
It sounds almost like we would need a whole other program to get even deeper into the medicine wheel. We only have about 2 minutes left, Phil, so I just wanted to ask you if people in the audience want to learn more about your work. Can you tell us where people can go and provide some website information?
Sure. We have a website. It's called yourlandmainly.org. And we're right now running a nonprofit foundation, and we have a community garden, and we have a studio downstairs where we do musical projects. And my wife is an artist. She did all the artwork for Inspirata Americana when we were on the road, and she takes in students now. And we have a NitroPack service where we're able to help people to store food for long-term storage. And so, you know, these are the things that we're doing now. We're working hard. We're retired, and it turns out that we're working harder than we did when we were on the road. I did get tired of being on the road. For 32 years is a long time on the road.
That is, but you're still making your music and doing the drum circle every week and living out the Medicine Wheel philosophy right in.
And
we're also
participants in the 8,000 drum Otomi ceremony, and on the solstices and on the equinox, people get together from 92 countries now to drum, pray, and meditate for the health and the well-being and the recovery and the purification of the Earth Mother.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Phil. It's been a great pleasure, and perhaps we can speak again in the future.
Okay, well, I'm certainly glad that I met you, and I'm glad you met me.
Same here, and I'm looking forward to receiving more of that music.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Barry Dwyer and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com, where you can find my own books on spiritual relationships, as well as a library of others. Please send your comments to contact@GodspeedInstitute.com. We love to hear from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems every week right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.